podcast hosted by yours truly, Garrett Kertef.
And Mansi Desai. We're two PhD students at UT Austin and best friends who love to nerd out about the brain, language, and music. In today's episode, we're going to have our very first guest, Dr. Liberty Hamilton, to talk about speech, EEG, ECOG, and so many other things pertaining to the brain.
Like Mansi said, for our second episode, we are really excited to have Dr. Liberty Hamilton on Brainwaves as our first guest.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
That's Liberty. Liberty is an assistant professor in communication sciences and disorders with a joint affiliation in neurology at UT Austin. Welcome to our podcast, Liberty.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Why do you think that we had you on? Like, why do we care about who you are? I guess
that's a loaded question right from the start.
Okay, there's an obvious connection between us that we haven't explicitly said. Liberty is our boss.
Yes, I am. So these two lovely people who you're listening to are my first PhD students here at UT Austin.
I'm also my first PhD student.
Yes.
Yeah, as am I.
You're not Bruce Banner with seven PhDs.
I thought you were on your second PhD, Mansi.
Oh, maybe my second degree.
Ooh. Yeah.
This is barely my first.
I have had people ask me that and talk about, isn't it Bruce Banner, the Hulk? He's got multiple. He's got seven PhDs, I think.
He's also
literally
really
why?
Big and green.
Exactly. That's what I said. If you've got seven PhDs, you're doing it wrong.
He's just a lifetime student.
Yeah.
I support that life.
Okay, Liberty, so you're our boss and you're on this podcast. Why do you think we invited you besides the fact that we want to get on your good side?
And that we think you're kind of cool.
Well, okay, these are working so far. So far, so good. I mean, one good reason is that I am really interested in scientific communication. So we are here in the Department of Communication Sciences and Disorders, but also in general, I think it's really important for people to talk about their research. And I like talking to you all about research, obviously, aww, since we work together.
And talking about research in a way that's probably applicable or generalizable to the public, because yes, maybe that's something that seems to be lacking in the scientific and academic community as a whole.
I think, yeah, that can be the case for a lot of people who don't think it's necessarily important, or also it's hard to talk about technical stuff when you get really deep into something. Sometimes it's hard to simplify.
It's really hard to simplify.
Mm-hmm.
I guess getting more and more into this PhD grind, it's really hard to communicate your science or what you're working on to other people in a way that people actually understand what the heck you're talking about.
Yes.
I can barely communicate my science to myself. So I like science communication because it helps me understand what I'm doing.
Yeah.
Very selfishly.
No.
So who are you? Like, where do you come from? Can you kind of tell us a little bit more about your background?
Yeah. So I guess before I was at UT Austin, if we go backwards in time, I guess, right before this, I came from a postdoc at UCSF where I was working with Dr. Edward Chang, who actually both of you also happen to know.
Steady Eddie.
Yes.
Yes, that's how we met.
Yes, so that's how we met. And I'm really happy that you all are in my lab now. I got to steal you from Eddie's lab. Not really. So I was there doing a postdoc in neurosurgery. And I guess we'll probably talk about that a little bit later. But before that, I was at UC Berkeley.
Wait, hold that's, up. I don't think yeah, we've actually said what a postdoc is on this show before.
Oh, that's true.
And when I talk to my relatives about, they're like, so you don't become a professor when you get your PhD?
Oh my goodness, yeah.
So what is a postdoc and why do people do it?
Yeah, so that's a really good point. It really depends on the field as to whether you have to have a postdoc or not to get a faculty job. But especially in a lot of biological sciences, people do tend to do a postdoc for several years, maybe 1 to 5 years, I'd say is typical. But it's basically any work you do after your PhD. It's basically just being a scientist as a job.
Okay, so you have to be a scientist. So like, yes, if I go and like work at like P. Terry's after I graduate, that's not a postdoc?
No, okay. It would normally be specifically a research job.
In an academic institution.
Correct.
So you can't really go and work at Google and then be like, I want to get apply for a tenure track position afterwards.
That's changing now. So actually I have heard about postdoc. I think Google actually has some postdocs.
Mansi and I, our eyes just like bulged out of our
like,
sockets.
Oh.
We can work at Google and be a postdoc.
I believe that Google has postdocs, postdoctoral fellowships, and same with some companies like Genentech, which is another biosciences company.
Yeah, my aunt works there.
Yeah, my uncle works there too.
Okay, have, go.
Like half of UCSF is named after them, right?
Yes. Yeah.
So you were at Berkeley before your postdoc.
Yes.
And what were you doing there?
So I studied neuroscience at UC Berkeley as well. So I've been doing neuroscience for a while.
Go Bears.
What's that?
Go Bears.
Go Bears. Yeah. Did love my time at Berkeley. It's a really beautiful city, beautiful place to be. And it's also a big university, just like UT, actually. So lots of undergrads, beautiful big campus, but, you know, in a different part of the country.
I think the weather is better in Berkeley.
I would agree.
Y'all don't know what you're talking about. I went to Santa Barbara. There's no comparing the weather with anywhere else.
Yeah. Oh, so that Santa Barbara is better than anywhere else?
Weather-wise, location-wise.
Fair. Fair enough.
So, Monty, why aren't you in Santa Barbara right now?
Well, I came to work with Liberty.
Yeah.
See? I'm dropping my metaphorical mic right now.
So, at Berkeley, what were you... Well, I guess a little bit before Berkeley. So then before Berkeley, where did you go for undergrad?
Yeah. So for undergrad, I was at Scripps College, which is a tiny liberal arts college. It's a women's college, but it's actually on a campus where there's five different colleges that are all kind of in the same
place. So the Claremont College?
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's like Voltron.
I don't know what that is.
It's like the 80s mecha cartoon where they all like... combine into one big robot. Like one of the robots is like the leg. And
oh
then,
my God. I'd love to think about what type of robot Scripps is compared to all the other colleges. Yeah. Harvey Mudd makes the robot. They're the engineering college. That's for sure.
The Mudd Mind.
Yeah.
So Scripps.
So Scripps.
And you also studied neuroscience.
Right? I also studied neuroscience at Scripps.
Okay. But you also did other stuff too.
I did. So.
And I think that's really interesting.
Yeah. So yeah, for people who think that, I guess it does kind of sound like a typical, just like I've chosen the same thing the whole way along, but that actually really wasn't true. So when I was an undergrad, when I first started, I thought that I wanted to go into geosciences. So studying earthquakes and volcanoes and plate tectonics, like movement of the Earth's crust. But that didn't pan out so much. I ended up, I don't know, the classes I didn't like as much. But I ended up taking a neuroscience class and really loved it. But I also almost minored in Spanish and music. And so kind of all of my interests were kind of converging on this theme of sound and the auditory system and how we process sound, whether that's in a language that we're learning or when we're... So I'm a pianist, so in playing the piano or thinking about what... the brain is actually doing when we do either of those things.
Okay. So that's the beginning. We worked down. Now we're going to work back up.
Okay.
So when you were at Scripps, what was the first step you sort of took to get involved with doing neuroscience research?
Oh, that's a good question. I didn't do a lot of research as an undergrad, to be honest. So I was mostly taking classes at that point in time. I also didn't know... that I wanted to go to grad school for quite a while. So I'd taken a bunch of classes that were lab-related classes, but not much outside research. So then what ended up happening is I did research after undergrad instead as a full-time job.
So where did you do research? What did you do?
Yeah, we skipped over that one. So I did
research. We're working up.
Yeah, no, we went, I basically went through a bunch of the UCs, but not UC Santa Barbara. I'm sorry.
Yeah. So offended.
Yeah.
It's fine.
Oh, so, yeah. Garrett's like, it's fine. So I was at UCLA, which was relatively close to Scripps, just like distance wise. And so I didn't have to move that far. But I worked in the laboratory of neuroimaging, and I worked for Professor Catherine Narr, who is still there at UCLA in brain imaging.
I have to comment on that name.
Yeah.
It's Narr.
Narr.
Yeah. It's gnarly. It feels the same.
That was such a predictable comment coming from you.
Yeah, it was actually great. And I think that this was kind of the reason that I ended up going to grad school. So Catherine had a really small lab at the time. And when I was there, I think she didn't have any graduate students at all. She had a research assistant, Mala, who is now an anesthesiologist. But she and I, so it was me and Mala and Catherine for a while. And so it was just like us three. And so I got to do a lot of MRI scanning. I got to learn how to use an MRI scanner, how to run one. And I also learned how to analyze data, how to work with patients.
What kind of patients were you working with?
Yeah. So we were working with patients with schizophrenia mainly, and also their family members without schizophrenia, and then also people just from the general community. And we were kind of looking for differences in the brains that might show risk for schizophrenia.
So you were doing a lot of, well, you were, you know, doing neuroscience and you had all this other auditory interests. So kind of what was this bridge between maybe looking at mental health, mental illnesses, neuropsychiatric? Is there some sort of a bridge?
Yeah, I guess it was sort of a at the time that I was looking for jobs, I had reached out to some places that were more specifically auditory. And actually, one of the answers I got from a researcher was, oh, there's no money in music neuroscience. So that was actually a common. I cold emailed a lot of people to try and find a job. And most of them either, I think some people didn't respond, but then a lot of people just said, I'm sorry, I don't have any funding.
So for the kids, don't respond, that means ghost.
Yes, right? Exactly. So the ghost.
Millennial terms.
We have to hit with the lingo.
Yeah, yeah. So they ghosted me. But now I kind of understand people get a lot of emails. I get a lot of emails. I'm trying to be better.
Shout outs to anyone that Liberty has ghosted.
I'm sorry. Yeah. If you're listening right now, just email me again if it's important.
Email
it's fine.
Like five times.
Yeah, it doesn't annoy me. It's fine. It's a signal to noise ratio problem, which I realize is jargon. Yeah.
We'll probably talk about that going forward.
So, yeah, I didn't finish talking about Catherine Knarr, but her lab was I had basically reached out to the director of the lab that she is, she's part of this consortium that's many different professors who are all working on similar topics. And so I had reached out to the director of the lab, who at the time was Arthur Toga, and he didn't have any positions at the time, but he reached out to Catherine. And then we talked on the phone. I actually was in Colorado at the time, which is where my family is from. We actually didn't meet in person before I started on the job. It was a phone interview. And then I showed up. And the crazy thing was, and this is still the case, if you ever go to see UCLA's Neuroimaging Center, it's basically like working in a spaceship. So I got there on day one, and there's these like LED changing color lights and this weird wave thing and all these crazy screens with beautiful pictures of brains like moving around. And there was to get into the building itself, there was an iris scanner.
Oh my God.
This is like the most nerded out building I've ever heard in my life.
It was amazing.
But also like goals.
Yes.
I'm doing my postdoc at UCLA.
Yeah.
It's settled.
So it was just so insane because I remember, you know, I had talked to her on the phone and I really liked the sound of what she was doing. She described some of the projects they were working on and I thought, yeah, this sounds really neat. I want to find out what it's like to work with patients and to work on MRI. I'd never done it before. But then I got there and I was like, oh, is this real life? This is crazy.
Like I'm not in school anymore.
No. And I mean, luckily, the environment was also just super friendly, helpful, a lot of really smart people. Catherine was an extremely supportive advisor. And I think because she was so willing to kind of let me work on cool stuff, even though I was just a lowly research assistant. You know, I was 22. I had my BA, but I don't really know what was going on.
Been there.
Been there.
Yeah.
Pretty recently, actually.
Yeah. So I think that kind of settled it for me. And, you know, she let me work on some independent projects and work on some papers with her.
Sweet.
And she's a really good writer as well. So also the paper publishing, some of those experiences ended up being easier than I have now had experience with.
Oh my goodness.
I think if they had been really hard off the bat, I might have been a little more hesitant.
I've already felt demoralized as a PhD student.
Yeah.
So we won't go there. No, it's not your fault. There are names that shall not be named.
Yep. Shout out to the review process.
Yep.
Slops to the review process.
Both of those things.
Okay. Let's fast forward just for the sake of time here. So you're at Berkeley. Whose lab are you in?
So in Berkeley, I was in Xiaowen Bao's lab.
And what were you studying
there? I was studying the auditory system in a rodent model. So
what kind of rodents?
So mostly rats and mice.
Little ratos.
Yes. So looking at how their brains respond to different sounds, and also how being raised in an environment with certain types of sounds changes how much of the brain is devoted to those sounds.
So you were interested in auditory responses in these animal models?
Yes.
What does that involve?
So that involves playing different types of sounds and then recording responses. So you're playing a bunch of sounds to a mouse, let's say, and they're listening to those sounds. And then you can either do something where you stick an electrode actually in the brain, so it involves a surgery.
Okay, kind of like UCSF.
Kind of like UCSF.
We'll get to that in a little bit.
Yes. Yeah,
we talked about it a little bit on our last episode.
Yes, and so you're sticking an electrode into the into a neuron or into some brain tissue that records from a bunch of different neurons that are underneath your little metal electrode. And then you'll play different sounds and you'll see whether the neuron by your electrode responds. And you can play things that are really simple, like beeps, basically. So if you've ever had a hearing test, it's like those beeps.
Oh, yeah.
Like different frequencies and...
Mm-hmm.
You could also do something more complex, right? Like you could be like, hey, neuron, check out my mixtape and then see if it responds to it.
You really could. You really could. And actually, one of the stimuli that Xiaowen had used for a study was jungle sounds from a relaxation CD, I believe.
Oh, interesting.
So it was looking for examples of naturalistic sounds. And so this is one track that we had. Some that are maybe more relevant to mice are actually playing mouse vocalizations to a mouse to see how its brain responds. And a kind of cool thing with that that's related to what I do now is that those types of communication sounds will cause a different response in the brain than if you were to just play a simple tone that was at the same pitch, like same frequency as the vocalization. So those two things don't do the same thing.
So there's extra information going on beyond just the pitch, and the brain is encoding that in some way.
Yes. Yes.
Which I think is a nice little segue to your work at UCSF and also sort of by extension now.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. So now I'm kind of doing similar research, but
not in mice.
Not in mice.
Okay.
No. Now I'm working with humans, but I do want to say I'm not the person that puts the electrodes in.
Yes. Yeah, we talked a lot about this in the last episode.
So even though you are Dr. Hamilton.
Yes.
Not a medical doctor.
Not a medical doctor. I'm the fake kind of doctor. No, I'm a PhD doctor, which just means that I know a lot about a tiny little topic. I know a lot about a specific thing.
You're a specialist.
That's what a PhD is. Just a specialist.
So what were you working on in Eddie Chang's lab at UCSF?
So At Eddie Chang's lab, I was working on stuff that's really similar to what we now do in the lab. So a lot of that involves looking at how the brain responds to speech sounds. So like we're doing right now, like the listeners of the podcast might be doing, you're taking in sounds and you're turning these noisy sounds into words, sentences. You're maybe hopefully following the thread of what we're talking about.
Oh, speak for yourself. Yeah. I'm totally checked out right now.
Yeah. Or you're following whether, you know, we're making jokes or being sarcastic.
And you're looking at all these responses using electrocorticography, yes, which I'll give you the floor to explain.
Yeah. So I'm using electrocorticography, also sometimes called ECOG. Yep. And that's a method that records direct brain activity from the surface of the brain in humans. But
how?
Right.
How does that? What?
Yeah. Yeah. How, what, why? All of those are good questions.
Like, answer. Do people even volunteer?
Right. Yes. So in this case, we are working with a very specific set of people. So we're working with people with intractable epilepsy. And what that means is they have seizures that are caused by epilepsy, but they've tried multiple different types of drugs. They may have tried changing their diet, but none of this stuff has worked. So that's what it means to be intractable, is that they can't treat it.
It's a really rough spot to be in.
Yeah. So very difficult. And for a lot of people, both kids and adults, you know, it affects people's ability to hold a job or to go to school or to feel like they can leave the house and, you know, safely go somewhere without having to worry about having a grand mal seizure, which would be a large convulsive seizure.
So a grand mal is what I feel like most people picture when they think of seizures, but there's other kinds of seizures as well.
Yes, there are. And so you can also have types of seizures that look more like just a twitch or a specific movement of your face or your arms, or you can have people who look like they're staring out into space.
No movement at all.
No movement. Yeah. And so a lot of the time in kids as well, teachers, if they don't know, they might look at those children and say, oh, I think they're just spaced out and they're not paying attention. But they may be having what's called an absence seizure, where they are totally unaware, but they also just kind of check out for a few seconds maybe. And then they can come back and
pretend like everything is normal and just carry about life.
Yep.
Keep going on.
Yep, exactly. So for all of these types of seizures, if it is something that is, people who have intractable seizures, usually they do involve the sort of large grand mal type seizures as well. But these patients will actually go in for epilepsy surgery. And so this is a type of surgery where the electrodes are placed on the surface of the brain in an area that their doctor has an idea might be involved in being the source of their seizures. And so they'll record from that area while the patient is in the hospital and try and localize or basically pinpoint exactly where the seizures are coming from using neural activity that's recorded from these electrodes.
So there are ways to record neural activity that don't involve surgery. So why couldn't you just stick one of these people with epilepsy in an MRI scanner and figure out where their seizures are coming from that way?
Yeah. So a lot of the time people or clinicians, doctors do use a combination of other methods. So EEG is one method that's used to look for sort of overall left side versus right side seizures, maybe sort of more frontal or more towards the back. fMRI, it's harder to. So number one, movement matters a lot in an fMRI scanner. So if someone were having a grand mal seizure in the fMRI scanner, number one, it's not probably very safe. Usually you'd want to take someone out of the scanner if they're having a seizure. But also that's just, you're not going to get a very good picture of the brain. And that's kind of what you want with fMRI. And you know, when people are not having seizures, some of their activity might actually look fairly normal. So it'd be really difficult to tell from an fMRI scanner.
So going back, you know, prior to surgery, it's mm-hmm. not like patients are just going to automatically be admitted into a hospital and you're like, hello, this is your brain surgery day. Mm-hmm. We're going to temporarily stick electrodes in your brain or on the surface to figure out where these seizures are coming from. There's a lot that happens before. So you mentioned EEG. So, you know, one of the things that we saw often is patients were in the epilepsy monitoring unit for a couple of days with scalp EEG. Do you want to yeah. explain a little bit about that?
Sure. And this is probably where it'd be good to have more guests who do the video EEG.
Oh, which, we will.
Yeah, you might be able to do.
Oh, we will.
But video EEG is basically what you said, which is that, of course, before just sticking electrodes in someone's head, you want to make sure that this is a good idea in the first place and that the seizures themselves are coming from somewhere that's not the whole brain, but that is somewhere that you think is relatively localized. The video EEG, you would also have somebody in the epilepsy monitor unit and you're just recording from their scalp instead of from electrodes that are actually in their brain or on their brain. And this is much less invasive, obviously. Anyone could have an EEG done. It doesn't hurt. It's not
invasive.
Yeah.
Every single one of us in this room, we've all had an EEG.
So, okay. So then fast forward. Mm-hmm. So patients have had their surgery. They've had these electrodes placed on the surface of the brain. They're in the hospital for anywhere maybe between, you know, a couple of days to unfortunately several weeks, depending on when these patients have seizures. So where does the role of the researcher come in? You're a postdoc. You're doing research. So what were you doing?
Right. So my role when I was at UCSF was to be someone who would come in usually several days after the first surgery, which is the one where they put the electrodes in. And again, those electrodes are temporary, so they would really only stay in there, as you said, up to a few weeks total. And so after a few days, we would go in and speak with the patient and then ask them if they felt like doing some different auditory tasks. And what that means is just, do they want to listen to sentences that we have, or do they want to listen to some different tones, beep sounds, things like that. And then we would look at what exactly the brain is doing while they're listening to those sounds. And I don't know, I think one nice thing for some people is that it's a way to pass the time. And because it can be, you know, even though people have had brain surgery,
it can be so boring in a hospital.
Really boring. Yeah.
Your options are like sit there or listen to beeps.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and people, you know, people didn't always want to participate, and then that's fine too. Yeah, we just wouldn't. And so it was always kind of up to the particular patient. Some of them really love participating in tasks. Others, you know, they'd do a couple and then they'd say, oh, no, I'm good. And yeah. it was great.
We had a couple patient reunions in the Chang Lab where prior research participants would come in and have a nice little catered dinner, and then we would present research and findings that we had found using their brain.
Yeah. And I think that was really cool for a couple of reasons. So I think it was really nice to be able to. So I participated in one of those and I got to, you know, show some people what we had actually done with their brain data, which is really cool. But I think also an added benefit to the patients is that they hadn't met each other. And so I think also from that experience, I noticed that it was nice for some of these patients who'd all gone through this experience of being in the hospital, having electrodes in their brain. It's not that common of an experience.
Incredibly rare.
As you can imagine. I was just looking this up actually, and I think the statistics were something like 1% of the population has epilepsy, and then 20 to 40% of those people may have intractable epilepsy. So anyway, I think, yeah, it was nice because they got to meet other people who've gone through the same thing and kind of chat.
So what were these findings that you were sharing with the patients at UCSF? Like what was your big break?
Yeah. So we had a couple of different things that were really exciting, but I think the main one was one of the things that we are still trying to piece apart, and actually with both of you in our research as well, is kind of how different sounds are mapped onto the auditory cortex, so the part of the brain that responds to sounds. Is there a map where if you looked in one brain area, it always responds to the same word? Something like that.
Across patients.
So looking for maps that are, yeah, consistent across multiple people. And I will say for the words, we did not find that so much. One finding that had been seen before was that this particular area of the brain that we were recording from, which is called the superior temporal gyrus, it's just a part of the temporal lobe.
The STG.
Yeah, you know me.
Dirty brain jokes.
Why don't you spit a bar or two, Liberty?
That's not.
The STG.
That's all I got.
So you're saying that you were looking at responses to words in the STG and you didn't find this sort of word map. So
right.
What did you find?
Right. So we had seen previously that something that the STG really cares about are phonemes, and specifically what are called phonological features. And
hold
maybe,
on.
Yeah, as
hold
the linguist,
on. Oh yes,
you
okay.
might want to explain that.
I'm the linguist. Okay, so a phoneme is essentially a unit of speech. So if you take a word like cat, you can break it up into the composite sounds. K-a-t. So the word cat has three phonemes. However, this isn't always necessarily a one-to-one mapping with writing. So some words have a lot of letters, but they don't have a lot of phonemes, or vice versa.
Okay. And then what about if you had to describe? So one of the things we found is that the brain didn't care about the single phonemes, but it did care about these different classes or types of features that allow you to describe each of the phonemes.
Yes, the phonological feature.
Yes.
So all the sounds in human language, except, well, for the purposes of this explanation, all the sounds in human languages are produced with the mouth. Now, there's only a certain amount of sounds you can make with your mouth. I encourage our listeners at home to try to make as many sounds with their mouth as they can right now. Don't do that. It might take a while. But essentially, the patterns of sounds that you can make with your mouth sort of exist in two dimensions. There's the place of articulation, and that's what part of your mouth are you making the sound with? So are you making it with your lips, like ba and ma and pa, or wa even? Or are you making it with different parts of the roof of your mouth, like ta, da, sa, ra? Those all have the same place of articulation. And the other way of grouping sounds is the manner of articulation. And this is what you do with the air that is flowing out of your lungs in order to shape it into a sound. So stops, or plosives for the linguists at home, are ones where you make a complete closure of the airway and then release it. So pa, ba, ta, da, ka, ga are all stops. Another example would be fricatives. And this is where you tighten the airway so the air goes through it faster and makes a high-pitched noise like s, z, sh, zh. So What does all this rambling about phonological features have to do with your research?
Like, yeah. So basically we found that, so Eddie's lab and in particular Nima Mezgarani had shown that the STG responds strongly to these different phonological features. So if you recorded with an ECOG grid and you looked at specific electrodes, so specific sites in the brain, some of them would respond more to plosives, like you demonstrated. And then other areas might respond to low back vowels, for example, or fricatives. So you could have an electrode that really responds a lot when you hear f, s, and sh.
And that's because all those sounds you just made share a feature.
Correct. Correct. And so really we found, or they had found, that manner of articulation was super important. And so that was kind of the start of my project. So I had wanted to know, was that phoneme map the same from person to person? Could you always look at somebody's superior temporal gyrus, their STG, and see the same vowel area in everybody and the same fricative area right next to that?
Could you?
No. So, spoiler. So it, at least as far as we could see with our recordings, it was not that consistent from person to person. They definitely all had those areas, but they weren't in the same location every time.
But I mean, everyone's brains are different.
That's
so,
yeah.
Maybe that plays a part.
That could
maybe
play
it
a part.
Doesn't.
Yeah.
I don't really know the answer to those questions.
I think that's a very good point. So, I mean, if you think about just how different everyone's fingerprint is, your brain is also very different. We all have some of the same brain structures, just like how, you know, most people have a thumb and an index finger. You know, most people have a superior temporal gyrus, but it might be bendier, it might be straighter. Just kind of depends.
All right. So you didn't find that these manners of articulation were the same across different people.
Right.
But you found something that was the same across people.
Yeah, we did. And so we actually ended up, we tried looking for a bunch of different types of features. That was what we first tried was, okay, if it's not the phonemes, is it the syllable? Is it the change in the envelope? I mean, lots of different things. But what ended up working was this method where we just looked at what, so I'm trying to think of a way to say this in a simple way, but basically we're looking for types of responses that were consistent across people, and the two types of responses that we saw most often were this onset, where basically there were brain areas that would respond really strongly at the onset of a sentence or after a short pause. And it even if somebody continued to talk, it would not, you wouldn't see any more response. You'd just see a response at the onset and then it kind of goes back down. Yeah, one and done. And then in other, so, and that was in pretty much all the people that we looked at, that was in this very sort of localized area of STG. And then as we went further forward, there were totally different responses, and those ones were much more sustained. So you would have a response that, you know, started to track whatever phonological feature that brain area cared about, but it wasn't only at the onset. So you basically, if you had an aw selective electrode, always responds to aw, same amount.
So it just kind of hums throughout whatever you're listening to.
Yeah. And it, I guess it's more like, basically think about like if the beginning of the sentence was really loud. So Sarah likes snakes, like that. So let's say that was an onset response of electrode.
Can Monty do the sustained for us?
Oh, like Sarah likes snakes.
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
And more.
Yeah. Yeah. So lots of sus. Yeah. So that's the general idea. It's like it'll be more.
I'm a slithery snake.
It would be more active, but it would be active the same amount for all of those S's as opposed to an onset selective electrode, which would just like the first one.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
So those are some really interesting findings.
Yeah. Yeah. And so this is something that I think is important for a number of reasons. So first of all, the responses are super fast. And so I think might be very important for helping us to segment different stimuli. We're now trying to look at how those might be involved in segmenting speech and background sounds. So in a much more natural context, like.
Yeah. So like, what are we doing?
Yeah.
What's your lab?
I'm going to defer this question to the other people in the room. I don't know what I'm doing.
Good representation of what's going on in my lab.
We have a lot of different stuff going on in the lab. Yeah. So I guess we can start with more of this, you know, what we described in our last episode of speech perception, and then maybe kind of expand that a little bit more to this combination of speech perception and speech production?
Yeah, yeah. So right now, I mean, I think you both can add on to these things since these are projects that you're working on. But yeah, we're trying to look at both the sort of how the brain processes sounds in a natural context, like I said. So we're actually trying to use more naturalistic and kind of fun stimuli, because one
fun
thing,
stimuli.
Well, real talk, right? So if anyone in the audience has been a research participant, or even if you haven't, a lot of research participation, super boring.
It's so boring.
It's really boring. And you know, it's helpful because you can do these very beautifully controlled experiments. But if you have to sit in a room and just listen to the same word repeated over and over, or even the stuff that I did was, you know, listening to sentences that
have you got enough blankets
don't make very much sense. And we're still using,
like I'm still using that.
Still using that, by the way.
For whoever participated in my EEG test, I sincerely apologize. I hope that was a little bit, you know, offset by those fun movie trailers.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, hold on. Now I need to apologize to all my participants because they got the boring sentences, but they didn't even get the fun movie trailers.
You need to really apologize to me first.
Okay, Monsi, well, is it a HIPAA violation if I say you were in my study?
I just disclosed that.
Okay. Well, Monsi, you were in my study, and I'm sorry that you had to go through it.
I accept your apology publicly.
I'm glad that.
So, I think
this
that,
is all coming out.
Yeah, this is like group therapy, essentially.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so I think the kind of common, there's like two real like research threads that run through our laboratory.
Mm-hmm.
The first is like, what are we studying? And the second is, how are we studying it?
Mm-hmm.
So what we're studying is these sort of response profiles in the brain when you listen to or produce speech.
Right.
So the onset and the sustained response profiles, these regions. So Sarah likes snakes and Sarah likes snakes. That's my onset and sustained. So we're studying stuff like that. But then how are we doing it? We're using these naturalistic stimuli, the
yes.
fun stimuli,
yes.
the movie trailers, the weird sentences that don't make any sense.
And we're using a couple different methods of being able to record neural activity. So we are using ECOG.
Yes.
In pediatrics and adults.
Yes.
And
question mark?
Question mark.
Eventually.
Eventually.
Yeah.
And we're also using EEG, which is the setup that we have downstairs in the basement with healthy participants.
Mm-hmm.
So people right. who are not in the hospital.
Right.
Like right. Monsi.
And
Garrett.
Yes.
We've both been like participants in each other's studies.
Yeah. And one other thing I would mention too, so we didn't really talk about this yet, but the transition also from working in mostly adult populations with epilepsy patients. Now, a lot of the work that we're doing is in pediatric populations. And so I think there it's even more important to have tasks that kids want to do and that they find fun, because already they're in a hard spot. They're, you know, in the hospital, it's boring, or they're, you know, not necessarily super happy to be there. Although some of the people that we've worked with, I think have had a lot of fun with our tasks too, which is great. And so I think having things that are more like watch a little movie clip, that's something where people would do that anyway. And so, yeah, the other point that you brought up. So using these multimodal techniques where we're using both EEG and ECOG is great, because then we can also directly compare brain responses to these types of, so to the same stimuli, and try and get a sense of, you know, what exactly can we measure with scalp EEG signals and how does that compare to what we're seeing in ECOG?
I think what we do is really cool.
I do too. That's
keeps
why I
us
do
busy.
It.
It sure does.
And okay. just a lot of head banging.
Yes. I think yeah. that's a normal component of research.
Grad school.
Yeah.
Anyways, so I think that we all think that our research is cool, but Maybe our listeners don't think our research is that cool. So if you could have a non-scientist remember one thing about your research, what would it be? Like, what's the big takeaway of all of this?
What's your overall goal? Like, what is the mark you want to leave?
In the world.
In the world with your research.
Yeah. I think having a really detailed of understanding of the maps that are in our brain that are actually relevant to our natural world. That's something that I would like to do. And I think in general, I hope that by knowing that type of thing, we can also improve what people call outcomes after surgery. So if we know where these language areas, where these speech and language areas are and what exactly they're doing, then for people who have to have brain surgery, we'll have a better idea of how to help them afterwards if they have any trouble with their language or memory.
Or even people who have, you know, suffered a stroke or have some sort of paralysis and we need to be able to help them communicate.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And actually that's another research arm we didn't talk about, but
to be discussed on a future episode. So, you know, we want to do like a just some shout outs. So is there any, you know, shout out to someone or something that you're proud of?
Yeah, I guess I would like to shout out to all, this is, I guess, multiple people, but all of the patients who have helped with the recordings, both yes. past and present, who we've worked with. I mean, I've met so many different types of people, and it's been really humbling and just, I don't know, really, I'm really thankful, and I realized that I wouldn't have a research program without some of these participants who are willing to volunteer their time. And then also I'm thankful for my students, both of you.
Aww, we're so touched.
Students and my undergraduate students. I feel like whenever, I'm not that jaded yet, but I think, you know, whenever I personally get down, it's really fun to see how excited sort of both grad and undergraduate students get about the research that we do or about the brain. And that I find really energizing.
Now we're going to do the opposite. Is there anybody or anything you would like to complain about in a public forum? We got our props. Now we got to do our slops.
Yeah. Do you both have to shout out and slop things?
No, just
no, just you.
Oh, no.
That's the best part of this segment is that we don't have to do it.
We can put our guests in the hot seat.
Yeah.
So let that seat sizzle a little bit and then think about any slop you want to throw out there
slops
into the inner sphere.
60 hertz noise.
Oh, my God.
Yes.
Mad
slops to all of the noise and artifacts and nano rejection.
Yes. Yeah. Should I briefly explain what that is or should we just leave it?
We'll leave it at that. I hate noise.
Yeah.
Messes up my data.
Let the signal out.
Free the signal.
Hashtag
free the signal.
Yeah.
Well, Liberty, thank you so much for being our guest on this episode. It's been awesome talking with you.
Yeah. So, Garrett and Monsi, have you solved the brain yet?
As always, thanks to Ryoso for our intro and outro music. Check out all his tunes in the link below. Thanks to UT Austin's Moody College of Communication for letting us record using their facilities. See you next time.